May it please the court, my name is Lawrence Kaplan. I'm the attorney for Gary Denson. I know the court has read the facts in this case, and normally we would immediately go to argument, but I think the facts here are interesting in terms of setting what's going on in this case. Gary Denson, say a middle-aged black man, got a job at Steak and Shake, and he worked as a counterman. As a counterman, he had various duties. He worked there for approximately 2 years. He did not ask for accommodation as regards his duties while working as a counterman. There were no negative comments or disciplinary actions regarding Mr. Denson. One part of his duties was lifting a large container of, I guess, milkshake material, which was about 60 pounds or so. He did ask for help, and the record is such that he did indicate to one of his managers that he had certain disabilities. About 2 years into Mr. Denson's employment with Steak and Shake, he was taken off work for a so-called safety evaluation. While he was off work for the safety evaluation, a doctor made a determination that Mr. Denson was not fit to fill the position of the counterman. And at the same time, Steak and Shake did not offer to engage in any kind of interactive process to potentially put Mr. Denson into another position that he could handle. What's interesting about this case is that it was Steak and Shake that terminated Mr. Denson. It wasn't Mr. Denson who proclaimed he was unable to do the work, had a disability, and therefore he had to ask for an accommodation. Now, in their argument, Steak and Shake makes the argument that, first of all, that their specifications as to jobs, whether or not that's how the job is performed or not, are what counts in this particular case to determine whether or not the individual could do the job. Steak and Shake also argues that during the course of his employment, he never asked for accommodation, and so therefore they shouldn't be under any obligation to engage in any interactive process of accommodating Mr. Denson. The problem with that is that Mr. Denson was terminated prior to the time that he could ask for any accommodation. The man was working, he did his job, well, he worked for 2 years, he was taken off for a safety evaluation, and he was terminated. We believe that the interactive process is an inherent part of the relationship under the law, under the ADA, and I believe this court, a number of decisions, has held so. It is the law, and there is a requirement on the employer to engage in such a interactive process. Steak and Shake argued that such an interactive process would have been futile because of the fact that at the particular store that Mr. Denson worked, there was only two other positions that he could have possibly held with his particular disability, and those were already filled, and in fact, if he had to take one of those positions, he would have had to bump another disabled individual. The problem with that argument is that Steak and Shake is a large employer. It has over 10,000 direct employees and probably 100,000 indirect employees in terms of franchisees and whatever. St. Louis, however, happens to be one of five districts of Steak and Shake that are all company-owned stores. And Steak and Shake made no attempt to determine whether or not there were open positions that Mr. Denson could have held anywhere in the St. Louis metropolitan area.
I'd like to ask you a question about whether Mr. Denson was qualified for the position. How do you get around Alexander, which basically says that, well, an employer is entitled to look at what the medical doctors say about the limitations and that the subjective beliefs or hopes of the individual employee can be disregarded by the employer?
I don't think we're arguing that point. That's the issue of whether or not Denson should have remained in his position as a counter employee. Denson, in fact, proved that he could do the job in regard to what your Honor is talking about, because he did it without a problem for 2 years. Now, I understand the employee's own ideas of what he or she can do are not necessarily the standard. On the other hand, there was proof that he could. But that's not our, that is not our crucial issue as far as we are concerned
so,
in this
so
case.
So yours is the accommodation.
Yes, ma'am. And the fact is that they did not engage in any interactive process to determine whether or not Denson could have filled two other types of position which are held within Steak and Shake. There's also no evidence on the record as to what, in fact, those positions, in fact, require. There are the Steak and Shake job descriptions. However, in fact, the reality is probably in all of these, in their stores, there are times when these employees sit down. Now, one of the issues regarding Mr. Denson is whether or not he could be on his feet for an hour at a time rather than having some time to sit down. And Mr. Denson testified that in one of the positions, I guess the prep person position, they did sit down on a stool from time to time. He, as a counterman, while he was working, had time to sit down. And I'm sure that there's other evidence regarding the other position we're talking about as a host, the host of the various Steak and Shake stores. This court has held in the Feidley versus UPS case that it's not only the current positions that you have to look at as far as accommodation is concerned, but you have to look at what might reasonably occur as far as being open in the near future. Now, if you have 30 or 35 stores, I don't know what the exact number is, in the St. Louis metropolitan area, I'm certain that there's a turnover all the time. And the potential of there being an opening in one of the two positions that Mr. Denson could have filled, that being of the host or prep person position, since there is this kind of turnover, since there is 35 stores, since they do have three shifts or how many shifts they have at least two and probably three shifts. So you take that number of stores, say it's 30 for argument's sake, times three, that's 90 possible positions for one position. If you double that, you've got 180 potential positions that this gentleman could have filled within the St. Louis metropolitan area.
Is this an issue that the district court addressed? Did you raise the issue of the potential accommodation in other Steak and Shakes?
I think an employer is defined as an employer, and the positions within an employer are not simply one store. It's employer-wide. There's no law that I could find that says that the obligation of an employer who has multiple locations is limited solely to the one store, the one location where the individual is working. So when you say there was no accommodation, and the court raised this herself, when there was no accommodation for Mr. Denson, you just can't look at the particular location where he was looking. The same way, for example, a driver for UPS, if there's various UPS facilities throughout the St. Louis metropolitan area, FedEx positions and so on and so forth, you can't just look at the one store and say, well, there was no position open at this store, our obligation is over. I think there's a particularly greater burden on the part of Steak and Shake in this particular case because they are the ones who terminated the employment. Maybe they had grounds to do that because he couldn't fulfill the position, even though he demonstrated he could. But let's go with the doctor's diagnosis, saying he couldn't handle the counter position. The fact of the matter is he could have handled other positions, or at least there should have been a finding of fact as to whether or not those positions, he could have filled those positions. And simply saying that were the two positions in the one store and they were already filled is not sufficient.
So, but didn't those other positions also require some standing, or are you saying that that just wasn't a fact that was found on that?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Weren't the other positions, didn't those require some standing and walking as well that would have been restricted for him?
That is correct, but the diagnosis was that he should not be standing more than 45 minutes an hour. And so that meant that there was time at the times in which he could sit, and if these positions had time in which he could sit, for example, if times are slow when a host is there, the host, the person who's the greeter, could be sitting down, and the same thing is true for the so-called prep person. They do have a stool where they sit. These people don't stand, even though the job description says they stand. The reality is they don't stand all the time. They have this opportunity. And if you've ever been in one of these stores, you can see at various times even the waitresses are sitting down and so on and so forth. So the idea that this wasn't available for this gentleman, there is no finding of fact as regards the specifics of these various jobs.
Well, wasn't there some sort of moving target on what the exact limitations were? Dr. King came up and stated that there were a series of limitations. Then Dr. Lux says that that he's limited to sedentary and clerical work, which if you look at the definitions of that are usually used in disability cases, are more limited than what Dr. King had originally said. Then Dr. King comes back and says he agrees with Dr. Lux's limitations. And if we accept, I get that this is all, still complicated, but if you look at it, if you take Dr. Lux's limitations then as being what's out there, would these, and these job descriptions by definition are having a hard time fitting sedentary and clerical, you're saying that on the ground, you could make that fit, right?
And I think the evidence is that if we have evidence in this case at the trial level, that evidence can come out that on the ground you have time to sit. Mr. Denson, there's no testimony from the other side in this regard other than the job descriptions, but Mr. Denson made clear that as far as he knew, the prep person, for example, had a stool back there that he could sit on. I can see him out of time at this point in time, and I will cede my position at this point.
Very well. Mr. Schenberg?
Thank you.
Good morning. You may proceed.
May it please the court. The only reason the plaintiff lost his fountain operator job at Steak and Shake is that two doctors medically disqualified him from working it. Their restrictions also medically disqualified him from working three other positions that he says he should have been given. My friend on the other side has ignored that all these facts have been deemed admitted by the district court because plaintiff failed to controvert any of them when they were set forth in the defendant's statement of material facts. Plaintiff has tried to avoid the consequences of the undisputed medical evidence, and I will address his arguments. But the reason that summary judgment was correctly granted is quite straightforward. The ADA covers only those it calls qualified individuals with a disability. That means even a disabled employee is covered by the ADA only if he can nonetheless perform the essential functions of his job with or without an accommodation. And as Judge Kelly identified, the Alexander case says that when medical opinion holds that an employee is unable to perform a particular function, that settles the ability issue as a matter of law. Judge Kelly and Judge Erickson, you're both also familiar with the same principle from the Moses versus DeSole Falcon Jet case. Here, plaintiff admits that his doctors prohibited him from working any job except a clerical, sedentary job. And they forbid him from working any job that required any lifting whatsoever. Plaintiff admits that the fountain operator job required extensive standing and lifting. Plaintiff also directly admits the fountain operator job was thus incompatible with his doctor's restrictions. Accordingly, the district court correctly held that plaintiff could not perform the essential functions of the fountain operator job. Now, the district court then went on to consider whether plaintiff might be qualified because he could perform with an accommodation. He can't do that either. Plaintiff has the burden of showing that there is, in fact, a reasonable accommodation available. Plaintiff has identified to the court the host, dish room, and prep positions. But plaintiff has offered no evidence he was medically qualified for those positions either. And in fact, plaintiff admitted in the district court that all three positions also require standing most of the time.
Is there a factual dispute about how much standing is actually required in each one of the identified positions?
There's not, for two reasons. And that is one of plaintiff's arguments. He talks about this 45 minutes out of every hour of standing and that's in fact the limit. But that ignores that was Dr. King's preliminary evaluation. Then he administered some treatment to the plaintiff. The plaintiff didn't respond to it. And Dr. King ultimately settled on the final medical opinion that Dr. Lutz's original restrictions of clerical, sedentary, no lifting work only, that was it. And that was later confirmed by another Dr. Cohn, who comes in a year later into the record. But there is no medical dispute. And even if that evidence wasn't as clear as it is, plaintiff admitted it by failing to controvert the evidence in the statement of material facts. So the essential facts are all established and undisputed and undisputable at this point. So The plaintiff is medically disqualified not only from his fountain operator job, but also from the only other jobs that he suggests would have been reasonable accommodations. Now, plaintiff has made, as I said, a variety of arguments to avoid that conclusion, but all those arguments ignore either the undisputed facts or the law or both. On appeal, plaintiff has attempted to argue as if he has an accommodation claim, ignoring that he didn't assert a need for an accommodation in his charge or his complaint. Instead, he only exhausted and pleaded the distinct claim of disparate treatment. So this argument about interactive process shouldn't even really be here. But it doesn't matter at the end of the day.
The district court addressed it, though, did it not?
The district court addressed only the issue of whether he was a qualified individual with a disability, and that is looking at whether he could do the essential functions of either his job or one of the proposed accommodation jobs. But at the end of the day, I don't want to even get hung up on the procedural issues because it doesn't matter. Even if plaintiff had a proper accommodation claim, it would fail for the same reason that he's not a qualified person with a disability. Again, in Moses versus DeSole, Falcon Jet, as this court recognized, even a failure to accommodate plaintiff first has to establish that he's a qualified individual with a disability. And of course, plaintiff can't do that for the reasons I've just described. Moreover, there is no independent legal claim or liability for failing to engage in an interactive process. The plaintiff still has to show that there was a reasonable accommodation available that it could have been given, but plaintiff can't do that because the undisputed medical evidence makes clear that plaintiff can't do the jobs he now says he should have been assigned to. And it doesn't matter what store, he is limited to clerical and sedentary work, and all three of the jobs that he proposes require, by his own admission, extensive standing, standing most of the time.
Is it essentially your argument that if, in fact, there were questions of fact that had been raised or preserved, that Mr. Dennison would then drive himself right into an Alexander problem? Because at some point you'd have the doctor's description of the clerical and sedentary work that he could perform. His claim would be, well, there's other, you know, my abilities are somewhat broader than that, and these jobs are therefore different. And aren't we then right where you've got the Alexander problem, where you're saying you don't have to take the speculative opinions of the injured parties view of what he or she can do?
That's exactly right. And, of course, it's not the case that Alexander only dealt with the initial job. Alexander also involved proposed accommodations, and the court simply said, but those all require the same essential function that the doctor already says you can't do. So, sorry, but you're not a qualified individual. And that's, of course, the same as it is here. I should also point out there is no duty to engage in any interactive process unless the plaintiff himself triggers it by timely asking for an accommodation for his disability. The court held in Ballard v. Rubin, the employer must know both of the disability and the employer's desire for accommodations for that disability. But none of this about a dishroom job or prep position or host position, at least in the context of as an accommodation for a disability, ever came up until litigation. The plaintiff, of course, he admits that he never asked for any accommodation for his sedentary, no lifting restrictions. The fact is, and the record shows, as he admits, he hid those restrictions. He had those sedentary, clerical-only restrictions from the beginning, and yet he didn't disclose that to Steak and Shake. He disclosed that he had some kind of lifting restrictions.
This is a little different, though, because he didn't think he was limited. So he goes in and then...
It's not clear that a couple of things. One, what he thought subjectively about himself is irrelevant. He knew he had the medical restrictions, or should have known. He had Dr. Lux telling him, and he lost his previous job because of the same medical restrictions.
I guess my point is, on the accommodation issue, he's doing the job.
Yes.
I mean, the evidence.
He
thinks he's doing it fine, and then you pull him for a safety evaluation, and he says, I can do this, and then you tell him he can, and he gets fired. So I think his counter is, I didn't ask for anything because I thought I was doing fine.
That's fine, but the point is he didn't ask for anything, whatever his reasons are, and he says he couldn't have because, he didn't know his job was in jeopardy, but that's not when you're supposed to ask for an accommodation. In fact, it's too late to ask for an accommodation when you've already lost your job. You're supposed to ask for it because you need it. He didn't ask for it. Maybe he thought he didn't need it, but Alexander says differently. He couldn't. He was disqualified from those jobs from the get-go. He also, again, I've addressed this briefly, but this notion that Dr. King's initial evaluation said he could do 45 minutes standing and attempt to create some kind of issue of fact about whether or not he really could do these other three jobs, that's not what the record shows. The record shows that all the doctors are on the same page. He was limited to clerical sedentary work. He admits that the doctor said he was admitted to clerical sedentary work. He admits that all the other jobs require standing most of the time, and therefore a simple syllogism says that he's disqualified from all those jobs.
I want to go back to your comment that the idea that it's too late by the time you get to the point where you might lose your job. I mean, what you're really asking is some employee to have insight into his own physical condition, compare himself to other people on the job who may or may not be working with them, have self-awareness that his condition is imposing limitations that others may not have, and make this request prior to being told by anyone that he might have a problem. Is that really the standard that we're going to hold people to?
Well, the standard is, the legal standard for purposes of this case is that, first of all, he's medically disqualified from all these jobs, and therefore he loses regardless. And as to the timing, in a separate issue, in a separate case where it might matter, the timing is what the Ballard versus Rubin case says it is, and that is you have to ask for it. And that's in part because it's also unfair. Nobody wants a system where the employer has to go around and ask the employee, do you need an accommodation, do you need an accommodation, do you need an accommodation? And that would be the alternative. Otherwise, the employer gets stuck with failing to accommodate something it had no reason to know needed an accommodation. And frankly, there's, again, Judge Kelly, you're right that maybe he thought he didn't need the accommodation, but he could have asked for it at any point during the process. In fact, even when he was taken off the schedule for the safety evaluation, he didn't ask for it even at that point. It was only in his questionnaire, I think, to the MCHR that he hadn't ever mentioned any other positions. And even in there, he admitted he never asked for them.
Would you consider it timely if after the safety evaluation and he's being told he's being terminated, he said, well, wait, you think I'm not qualified? Well, what about an accommodation to?
No, it's take? Clear. It's clear. It's too late at that point. The law is clear at that point.
If it's simultaneous?
I think it's beyond that. At that point, the court says, and I can't put my finger on the case right now, but. What the court says, at that point you're asking for a reinstatement, you're not asking for an accommodation. I mean, the decision's been made at that point. If the decision's been made in the employer's mind, it's too late. And again, it doesn't matter for purposes of this case. The plaintiff simply isn't a qualified individual with a disability, and for that reason he can't get past first base, or can't get to first base in this case. For the same reasons that this court held in Alexander and in Moses versus DeSalle Falcon Jet, where there was a separate discrimination claim, which is the only claim that was actually brought here, and a separate accommodation claim. And the court, in looking at the accommodation claim, said, essentially, we don't even have to get to the second set of elements for that cause of action because you can't get past the qualified individual issue. And that's essentially the same issue here. Briefly, I want to address the fact that in the briefs, the plaintiff talked about he did request a host job at the store at his own location at some point. A mere request that I'd like a different job is not a request for an accommodation for a disability, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that it was anything other than, hey, I'd like to try to be a host at some point. And nothing to do with an accommodation for a disability. And, of course, the host job at that store was not a reasonable accommodation anyway because it was full. And even if he had requested it as an accommodation, and even if it had been vacant, and even if he had said, I want to be a host at any store you have in the United States, and the fact remains that the host job requires extensive standing most of the job. He admitted that. And the doctor's opinions that he also admitted say that he can't do a standing job, and that's really it. The district court got it right. The medical evidence makes clear that he's not a qualified individual with a disability. I just want to check here if there's anything else that I feel like we need to talk about, but I think we've covered it all. I should also point out that because plaintiff abandoned his retaliation claim in the district court, both of the original counts in this case were subjected to summary judgment order, and the district court summary judgment order should be affirmed in its entirety. Unless the court has any more questions for me, I think I've finished.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few points. I think we've got a kind of an Alice in Wonderland argument here by Steak and Shake, which we should address at least to a certain extent. The fact of the matter is the guy was terminated before he knew that he had any there was anything ongoing that meant he had to request an accommodation. So in effect, he was terminated. They took him off. They terminated him. And then they claim, well, you didn't ask for accommodation while you were on the job. The horse was already out of the barn. The guy was already terminated. And at that point, under these type of circumstances, it would seem to me there's an obligation on the part of the employer who is terminating an employee for his disability to offer to the employer, engage in an interactive process to say, well, what about, are you able to do any other jobs? Now, he said that he asked to do the host job while he worked at the store. They don't have anything to rebut that.
To what extent did your client request an accommodation as such?
He did not request an accommodation because at the time he was already gone. He was already terminated. So it's not like they were in a room together and they said, Mr. Denson, you're fired. They just let Mr. Denson know that he had been terminated. Now, let me paint a little bigger picture here. What they're also arguing is that you have to take a layperson who files a charge, and at the same time he files a charge, put in that charge that they failed to reasonably accommodate him. I don't know if the case relies on that or not, but the fact of the matter is there isn't a box in the EEOC charges for failure to accommodate. So to ask a layperson to raise that in a charge is just ridiculous. The second point is that under these circumstances, what allow Steak and Shake to do in a case like this is to basically have an employee who has some problems on the job, take him off, find that he's incapable of doing the job.
Let's see, would you speak directly into the mic?
I am so sorry. You have the individual who's on the job, you take him off, you determine that he's not able to do the job medically or for whatever reason, you terminate him, and then you say, whoops, you waived everything. You didn't ask for accommodation after we took those actions, and we are the ones who took you off the job. Now, it may or may not make any difference, but the guy did perform his job for 2 solid years without a problem. Yeah, he had a fall, and that was one of the issues during his 2 years. But he had no warnings, no disciplinary notices. As far as we know, the guy performed his job correctly. So whether or not a doctor says that he can or cannot do the job, and whether or not Steak and Shake's own individual job descriptions say that the job requires standing or not standing, is, in my position, as far as we're concerned, is irrelevant. They can't make their case on their job descriptions. And circumstances when they're the actor that terminates the guy on their own initiative because he's disabled, they have an obligation to say to him, is there any other job or are there other jobs that you think you can do?
Would that require us to sort of step out of our current case law and impose a new exception, I suppose you'd call it, or is there something that you can rely on that says
only in these unusual circumstances where it is the individual is terminated because of his disability because of the action of the employer. Thank you.
Very well. The case is submitted, and we will take it under consideration.